I want to start with a little bit of a follow-on from the last talk about not self and selfing, and just explore a little bit about the understanding into not self. Seems to happen in a couple of different layers. The first layer is the view of self, the idea, the belief in self as a concept, as a view. This is called Sakkaya Ditti, identity view, and that's largely the aspect that we explored a couple days ago, looking into that part of the sense of self. The subtler aspect of selfing is just the sense I am. This is called conceit in the Pali Mana. And there's one text that kind of elaborates or describes the difference between these two. It's a conversation between a monk and a group of bhikkhus. And the group of bhikkhus doesn't quite understand this difference. And so they're asking the monk about his experience with respect to the sense of self in the five aggregates. So I'm going to read you sections of this. At the beginning, the first question, the first time there's contact between this group of monks and the monk who will be giving the talk, his name is Kemaka. And they say, go to the monk Kemaka and say to him, do you assume anything with regard to the five clinging aggregates to be self or belonging to self? And his response is, concerning these five clinging aggregates, there is nothing I assume to be self or belonging to self. And so they basically say something like, then you must be an arhant. You must be free. You must be fully liberated. And he responds, while there is nothing I assume to be self or belonging to self, I am not an arhant. With regard to these five clinging aggregates, I am has not been overcome, although I do not assume I am this. And they get a little confused by this, so they ask more. Friend Kemaka, this I am of which you speak, what do you say I am? Do you say I am form, or do you say I am something other than form? Do you say I am feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, or do you say I'm something other than these? This I am of which you speak, what do you say I am? And Kemaka responds, friends, it is not that I say I am form, nor do I say I am something other than form. It is not that I say I am feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, nor do I say I am something other than these. With regard to these five clinging aggregates, I am has not been overcome, although I do not assume I am this. And he gives a simile. He says, it's just like the scent of a blue or red or white lotus. If someone were to call it the scent of the petal or the scent of the color or the scent of the filament, would they be speaking correctly? No, friend. Then how would they describe it if they were speaking correctly? And they respond, the scent is in the flower. That is how they would describe it if they described it correctly. And so he repeats, just so. It's not that I say I am form, nor do I say I'm other than form. It's kind of like this sense I am is suffusing, like the scent suffuses a flower. The sense I am suffuses the aggregates. A subtler kind of sense of self. Seeing clearly, as he describes, that he's not, is not that he says, I am form nor other than form. Not feeling nor other than feeling. And yet there's this sense, I am. So this is describing the difference between these two, identity view and this conceit, I am. And he goes on to describe how to practice to shift from one to the other. My understanding here is that he has heard this practice from the Buddha because he has not penetrated this in and of himself. He clearly says, I do not see this. I don't see through this I am at this point. But he goes on to say, here he says, even though a noble disciple has abandoned the five lower fetters, which includes this identity view, one still may have regard with the five clinging aggregates, a lingering residual I am conceit, an I am desire, an I am obsession. But at a later time, one dwells contemplating the phenomena of arising and passing away in regard to the five clinging aggregates, such as form, such as its origin, such as its disappearance, such as feeling, such as its arising, such as its passing away, such as perception, fabrications, consciousness. As one dwells contemplating the arising and passing away of these five clinging aggregates, the lingering residual I am conceit, I am desire, I am obsession is fully obliterated. And so he describes this is the practice for fully understanding not self, fully understanding, seeing through this sense of self, this sense of I am. The very happy ending of this Dharma talk, Kemaka gave, is that all of the monks that were hearing this Dharma talk became fully liberated, including Kemaka, giving his own Dharma talk. This makes me very happy. So he points to, and my understanding is that while he was giving this talk, he was seeing, as he was giving these instructions to them, he was seeing these aggregates, the impermanence of these aggregates. And the kind of little backstory here is that he was really, really sick. He was like on his deathbed, basically. And these monks were kind of coming back and forth to his deathbed and asking him questions. And they'd send somebody there to talk to him. And then he'd run back to the others. And it was this back and forth. And finally, Kemaka says, enough. Just help me walk and I'll go talk to them. And so he's been sick. You know, he just walked. He probably hasn't been off his bed in a long time. He walked to see these monks. My guess is that the experience of the aggregates was really predominant as he was giving the talk and really could see into the impermanence as he was exploring the teaching. And so this practice of seeing the impermanence of the aggregates and remembering that we talked about early on the definition of emptiness in the Theravada, being empty of self and what belongs to self. And so the seeing the impermanent nature of the aggregates uproots the conceit I am, allowing the seeing of the emptiness, another way to frame seeing of the emptiness of the aggregates. And so back to our simile sutta, seeing of the insubstantial, empty nature of the aggregates. just a reminder of that part, just the simile part. I'll just read one of the similes right now, just to remind you of the flavor of that, of the similes. And remember, there was a simile for each aggregate. Form is like a lump of foam, feeling like an airy bubble, perception like a mirage, mental formations like a banana tree, and consciousness like a magic show. Suppose that in the last month of the hot season at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to be void, empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in perception? That went through that for all five. And in the sutta, what follows that is that the Buddha says, seeing this way, basically, seeing this insubstantiality of the aggregates, one becomes liberated. And here's the passage. Seeing thus, the instructed noble disciple experiences disenchantment towards form, disenchantment towards feeling, disenchantment towards perception, disenchantment towards volitional formations, disenchantment towards consciousness. Experiencing disenchantment, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes to be the knowledge. It is liberated. One understands. Birth is ended. The holy life is fulfilled. The task is done. There is nothing further for this world. And so this process that's described as a result of seeing the insubstantial nature of the five aggregates, it's this fourfold process. We become disenchanted, dispassionate, freed, and then recognizing the freedom, understanding the freedom. I primarily will explore the first two of those, disenchantment and dispassion. I like the translation of disenchantment for this first word. We become disenchanted with form, with feeling, with mental formations, with consciousness. Basically, I like that because it points to essentially the magic show, the deceiving nature of being, not seeing the insubstantial nature. We are kind of enchanted by the magic show, enchanted by the illusions, the illusion of permanence, the illusion of substantiality. And so we become, through seeing clearly the impermanent nature of the aggregates, we recognize the illusory nature of the happiness that, and the unreliable nature of the happiness that has been riding in dependence on that. And these illusions are no longer satisfying. And so to me, that word disenchantment does really kind of, it's like, yeah, we become disenchanted. We're no longer enchanted. The princess has kissed the frog. There's this seeing through an illusion. And so we see that we have been deceived by ignorance, deceived by the spell it weaves through papancha, through this objectification, conceptualization, and believing that to be reality. We may not really see through it all the time, but every, you know, we can have my sense of this, you know, disenchantment. In this description, it sounds like one big, like, kablooey understanding. But it seems to be a more gradual process than that. That there are times when we see through that ignorance, see through those delusions, and see clearly. We've talked about this, some in the groups of, and maybe even in the hall, a kind of the sense of how obvious it seems sometimes that this is just impermanent stuff passing through. There's nothing to cling to. And it feels so clear. How can I not see this? And then the delusion comes back. And so we have a taste of disenchantment, a taste of the seeing through the illusion. But the illusion returns. And this is, in my experience, a process. So Bhikkhu Bodhi describes this experience of disenchantment in this way. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a commentary, a modern day commentary on a number of these aspects of the mind moving towards freedom. And he says this about disenchantment, the Pali word nibbida, which he uses here. Nibbida signifies, in short, the serene, dignified withdrawal from phenomena, which supervenes when the illusion of their permanence, pleasure, and selfhood has been shattered by the light of correct knowledge and vision of things as they are. The serene, dignified withdrawal from phenomena. In my experience, it's not quite so simple. Maybe ultimately that's the experience. But it feels more like there's a lot of layers of illusion. Many layers of illusion and the some layers. And we see through certain layers of the illusion. And then we have the sense of kind of ease for a while, perhaps. And then there's other parts of the illusion that come up. And there's different, many different emotional flavors of response to the seeing of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And so these, disenchantment is really kind of the deep touching into the impermanent nature of experience. And there's like different, it's almost like layers of clinging that get touched into and release. And at the very base, it's just like this deep, no, I don't. I want something to be stable. And so there's like different layers of letting go, layers and layers of letting go. So this term, nibbida, which Thanissaro Bhikkhu translates as disenchantment. That's the translation I'm preferencing here. Bhikkhu Bodhi sometimes translates as revulsion. This is another flavor of the relationship at times. Joseph described this to me, and I think he got this from commentary somewhere. He said this feeling of nibbida is like the disgust you feel when you're trying to get nourishment from something and you finally realize there's no nourishment to be found. It's just like this disgust. This is not useful. So, but revulsion and disgust in our language, in English, carry a flavor of aversion. And my sense of this disenchantment, it's not about aversion. It's about seeing through this illusion, recognizing that there's no nourishment here, as Bhikkhu Bodhi says, with a kind of serene, dignified withdrawal from something that we had taken to be nourishing, but is not. See that clearly, the lack of nourishment there. And Joseph pointed to a dog that might be gnawing on a dry bone, gnawing and gnawing out of habit of gnawing, but they're not getting any nourishment out of it. And finally, they just give it up. They just walk away from it. This is that quality of nibbida. There's nothing here for me. There are, in this kind of deepening kind of layers of clinging around the enchanted, the illusion, there's a lot of different relationships that we can we touch into around this. Sometimes it might be the feeling of overwhelm. Sometimes there's this, with this time and practice, a sense of things changing so rapidly. And so the impermanence seen so clearly, the kind of just things falling away and a kind of a sense of, oh, there's nowhere to land, and this kind of a feeling of overwhelm of how fast things are changing, and the sense of there's nowhere to land, and sometimes a sense of fear can arise with this. And what I want to point to here is that these relationships are like manifestations of the subtler levels of clinging. As we see impermanence at very clear levels, there are subtler and subtler kind of relationships that we have that we're clinging, that the mind's saying, no, I don't want to let go of the delusion of permanence. I don't want things to be impermanent. And so these different flavors are different relationships to that, and they're kind of human relationships. They're natural that we, it's very much that this is a human conditioning, not a personal conditioning. And so going through these emotional relationships as we see impermanence, it's natural. And the process around the practice unfolds through the meeting of these relationships. As we touch into impermanence, the meeting of these relationships. And so sometimes a feeling of overwhelm or fear when we're touching into impermanence. Might be a flavor of feeling like we just can't make sense of anything. The mind just doesn't get what's happening. And something feels really wrong. The important part here I want to just keep reminding is like noticing the relationship is really kind of how this unfolds for us in practice. That's where the clinging is seen, is in that relationship to the impermanence. If there's a sense of fear or overwhelm or something feels really wrong, the practice isn't what is it that feels really wrong, but oh, what is the feeling of really wrong? What is the feeling of fear? It's really simple, actually. It's the same practice, whether we are dealing with some kind of a hindrance of some kind. We want to know our relationship to that. As the practice moves into the kind of seeing of impermanence, we also really need to clearly see the relationship to impermanence. Well, there's different flavors, different relationships. Sayadaw Ujjanika, one of my Burmese teachers, pointed to a feeling of homesickness. That I resonated with. It's just like, yeah, I miss home. I miss the feeling of like somewhere to land. So homesickness can kind of be a flavor of it. Boredom actually can be a flavor. It's like enough already. I've seen like seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, smelling. Yep. I get it. There's a lot of it. Yep. Okay. Yep. So boredom sometimes can be the relationship. Sometimes a feeling of being burdened. Like, yeah, enough already. Does it ever stop? Disinterest. Yeah, I've seen it enough, really. I don't need to see any more of this. So many different emotional flavors here. As the mind sees through the relationship, you know, we see through these different relationships and these relationships begin to fall away, and then we're just in this deeper knowing of the impermanent nature of experience. There's a shift towards becoming thoroughly disenchanted. Disenchanted all the way down. All these levels of the ways we cling. And the shift is to this quality, dispassion. And dispassion, the Pali term is viraga. Which can be understood. It's often translated as dispassion, but a kind of more ordinary use of the word is fading away. And the analogy here, and the fading away that it's referring to is the fading of a dye on cloth. And so I like reflecting on the kind of the etymology of the words, because it speaks to something perhaps, that this place of dispassion has a quality of fading, again, rather than necessarily something sudden. There does apparently seem to be a point at which there's a full fading, but the process has a kind of gradual nature to it, perhaps, like the fading of a cloth that's sitting out in the sun for a long time. The dye gradually fades. And so in this place of having become, you know, more thoroughly disenchanted with experience through seeing its impermanent nature, that the illusion of permanence so thoroughly seen through that we can't be enchanted by it anymore. We just see there's no point to clinging. It doesn't make any sense to hold on to experience that is just vanishing, passing away, endlessly arising and passing away. It doesn't make any sense to hold on to it. And so the mind turns towards letting go. And it does seem like there are different things, different, again, kind of stages of this letting go. The Buddha describes a kind of fading of attachment in his own practice. I abandoned craving for sense pleasures. I removed the fever for sense pleasures, and I abide without thirst, with the mind inwardly at peace. I see other beings who are not free from lust for sense pleasures, being devoured by craving for sense pleasures, burning with fever for sense pleasures, indulging in sense pleasures, and I do not envy them. Why is that? Because there's a delight apart from sense pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, which surpasses even divine bliss. Since I take delight in that, I do not envy what is inferior. And so there's this kind of fading away of attachment to sense pleasure. And in a way, we can look at this kind of as a staged release, the fading away of the attachment of sense pleasure. But there may be for a time for us a kind of attachment to the pleasure of concentration, the bliss of concentration. But the fading of sense pleasure, kind of like the pleasure of the of concentration, the bliss of concentration being so much more delightful that there's no like pull back to sense pleasures. And again, this happens unevenly. In my experience, it's not that there's a taste of that bliss and then forever you're not interested in sense pleasure again. But it's a gradual kind of shifting there. And then the Buddha points to, in his own experience, that there's a pleasure, a delight that surpasses even that bliss of concentration. In a sense, he's pointing to the happiness of freedom. And in many places, as we've talked about, the Buddha pointed to letting go of wholesome states, that not even clinging to wholesome states is useful. Not even clinging to the Dharma, the views of the Dharma is useful. And so this kind of gradual staged fading away of the clinging to these. So again, in my experience, it's not that this fading is just one kind of gradual letting go. There can be an understanding of the non-usefulness of picking up sense pleasure at certain points. Just that, yeah, that is just doesn't make any sense. And then the ignorance comes back again. We're caught by that. And yet, having seen through it, we can understand the magic shows at work here. Ignorance is present. So there's a way in which the understanding that happens in this process of releasing disenchantment and the fading away, the dispassion, and that the understanding that comes supports us even as we get caught by ignorance again. The understandings that we've touched into can help us meet and open to and not be as caught by that ignorance. We know it's ignorance at work. So one piece that I reflect on around this dispassion, this fading away of attachment, is the recollection or the reflection that freedom is not described in terms of acquisition. It's not described in terms of anything we get. It's described entirely in terms of what is released. One definition of freedom: this is peaceful, this is sublime, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the ending of craving, dispassion, nibbana. And so here, there's an equating, in a way, that the term for dispassion is equated to nibbana. And so the full fading of attachments is this freedom. And another definition for nibbana: the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. This is nibbana. Not defined in terms of what's here, but what's released, What's not here? The non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so much our modality, you know, ignorance, the modality of delusion, thinks that we have to acquire to be happy. This just turns happiness on its head, this notion of relinquishment. And yet the interesting thing to me is it talks about what is relinquished. You know, we relinquish attachments. Greed, aversion, and delusion are relinquished. That description to me, and there's one place where the Buddha says, the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion, this is nibbana. And this is visible in this life, inviting, attractive to the wise. And so this is this description to me of the freedom from greed, aversion, delusion, visible in this life. It's not about like transcending into some otherworldly realm, but right in this life, a life can be lived free from greed, aversion, and delusion. And there's a lot of room for individual expression of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. I've met some monks in Burma, and I don't know where they were in terms of this trajectory of freedom. But I did have the sense that there was a lot of freedom in there, a lot of freedom in their minds, and boy, very different beings. One was just so peaceful, so quiet. I walked into his monastery and it felt like the quiet, it was like walking into a sea of quiet, just walking into that monastery. I was talking to Carol after that, and Carol Wilson, we were there together in Burma, and as we left that monastery, I said, Carol, I'm not usually like one that like feels these things, but I really felt before we even met the monk, like just walking into through the gate, it was like, whew. And she turned to me and she kind of laughed and she said, it's not subtle here. Another of these monks. So that first monk, he was quiet, and I love to go and talk to him and just sit in his presence, and we just had these quiet conversations. Just lovely being. And another monk we went to visit, he was just so happy. He was laughing all the time. I remember, maybe it wasn't the last time. Well, I'll tell two stories about him. They kind of really show this. The first one I'll tell, I think this was the last time I saw him. I went with Narayan and Carol Wilson again. We were visiting him, and Narayan asked if she could take a picture of him. And he agreed, and he went out and stood in the courtyard where she could take a picture. And monks in Burma are not supposed to smile for pictures. He had the hardest time not smiling. He was like... It was so tender and sweet to just see the joy just suffusing him. He was just such a happy being. And the time before I had seen him, we were visiting him after he'd been really sick. He had just, we had waited to see him until we had heard that he was okay to be visited. And we walked in, and And we asked him how he was doing, and are you okay, Sayadaw? And through the translator, you know, this was all through the translator, and it's so interesting because I just feel like I heard him say this directly, but he said, oh yes, I've been very sick. I almost died the other day. Just so much expression of freedom in such different ways. And so, you know, the idea we might have of the release of greed, aversion, delusion, dispassion, maybe that doesn't sound very appealing. You know, I don't know that I want that dispassion. But what it is freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion. Freedom from the illusions about reality. And in that, it seems that we open to these maybe sometimes personal qualities in a way. What's my most natural for a being? In one case, happiness, in another case, tranquility. Maybe in another case, action. Like the Buddha was very active, walking all over India and teaching and standing in battlefields, trying to stop war. It was very active. And so activity can be an expression of this freedom. Now, what are the ideas we have about dispassion? You know, let it go. Some expression of the absence of greed, aversion, delusion. You know, greed, aversion, delusion constrict us. They sap up our energy. The more we release greed, aversion, delusion, the more availability there is for care and love and compassion and connection. The wisdom that frees greed, aversion, delusion really leaves us in this place of responsiveness, responding to the world in our own unique way. And so the final links in this passage, experiencing disenchantment, one becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, the mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated. And so there's this, according to the commentaries, this is kind of a very natural unfolding. This is not so much a gradual process in my understanding, that with the full fading away of attachment, liberation happens. And with that comes the understanding of the freedom. And so there's this kind of interesting kind of weaving to me in this process of that's described of freedom, an interesting weaving of the heart being released and the mind understanding that release. To me, the sense of dispassion and liberation, that freedom is more of a heart response to the understanding, and then the understanding is more of the mind response. And remembering, you know, I haven't actually said this here, but many of you know that the word for mind in Pali, the word citta, has a dual flavor to it. It means heart mind. There's not so much a distinction. And so the liberation of mind is the liberation of heart. The liberation of the contraction of heart around greed, aversion, delusion. That liberation allows much more room for empathy, compassion, love. There's another teaching that uses these four links. These four stages that are described in this text are the last four links of a process of freedom that's described transcendent dependent origination. And this is a set of 12 kind of steps or processes that move us, support this process of letting go. And so the first part of the sequence kind of establishes the conditions that support seeing things clearly. The first half of this chain, these 12 links, the first half are conditions that support seeing clearly. And they include, basically, we meet suffering with wisdom. This is kind of the first piece, is this shift onto the path of this freedom, the path that leads to freedom, is that instead of meeting suffering with bewilderment, with more ignorance, there is this sense of wisdom meeting suffering and kind of this, maybe there's another way. And hearing teachings of there being another way, faith can arise. Faith is this first quality in these six steps. Faith, delight, joy, the first three steps, the first three aspects of this process of the qualities that support freedom. These are heart qualities. Faith, delight, joy, these are qualities of the heart. And then the next is tranquility, which has a cooling kind of effect on the mind, maybe more of a wisdom flavor, seeing that the qualities of faith, delight, and joy have a little bit of ripple to them, and the wisdom recognizing, oh, that ripple, ah, and a cooling of that. And then following tranquility is happiness, a quieter kind of contentment. And following from happiness is concentration. And these are understood to be a kind of one supports the next. With faith, delight arises in that faith. And with that delight, joy is a natural result. And with that joy as a natural result, tranquility begins to follow. And in the wake of that tranquility is happiness. And with happiness as a supporting condition comes concentration. And it is that concentration that allows us to see more clearly. Concentration might be the one-pointed concentration of holding on, knowing one particular object, but also as this teaching around seeing the impermanent nature of the aggregates points to, it might be the continuity of the awareness. Seeing moment after moment after moment, arising and passing, arising and passing, arising and passing. So this concentration supports seeing things as they are. And then following on seeing things as they are these four, disenchantment and dispassion, which to me are kind of heart responses to this seeing. Dispassion, maybe having more of a wisdom quality of recognizing, this is not worth picking up. That's another aspect of dispassion, I think. It at first might feel like a releasing, a letting go, but at some point, it's more of the recognition or the understanding that the mind just isn't picking up the greed, the aversion, the delusion anymore. So the mind, the wisdom quality here understands that. Nothing to pick up. I mean, it's not even that we have to think, don't pick it up. It's the mind just doesn't go there. It's kind of like the natural process of aging. You know, when we're kids, we have these toys and we are attached to them. And I remember for myself, there was this time of letting go. I felt like, oh, I'm too big to play with those dolls anymore. But, you know, there's still this pull and feeling like I don't want to let that go, and feeling like I had to grow up or something. And yet, as an adult, it's like, I don't even think about those anymore. You know, it's just, it doesn't even occur in the mind to pick that up. So this is the kind of quality of that dispassion, the not picking up of greed, aversion, and delusion, the not picking up of attachments, the non-arising of greed, aversion, and delusion. Disenchantment, dispassion, liberation, the word for this vimutti, sometimes translated as release. Also a feeling, a heart quality. And then the understanding of release, kind of more of a mind quality. And so this process of describing, you know, I did that in 7 minutes. This is a deep teaching that transcended dependent origination. But I just wanted to kind of go through it to point to this interweaving of cultivation of heart and mind. They come together in this practice. The qualities of love, of joy, of delight, of happiness are firmly on the path. They support the mind to let go. They support the freedom of heart. And so there's this sense for me, this is really why I wanted to describe this kind of interweaving of heart and mind qualities in this description of how liberation unfolds. To me, this describes a very integrated process, an integration of wholeness of heart and mind, non-separation of heart and mind. What's released is the forces that divide us. Not only the forces that divide us from one another, but the forces that divide us internally. And then as the Buddha, as an example, we live our lives. Without greed, aversion, and delusion. So to me, this is an inspiring vision. This freedom, not a kind of a sense of nothingness or not caring. In fact, really, it feels like the heart will care more deeply. What divides us from caring is the greed, aversion, and delusion. What keeps us attached is the greed, aversion, and delusion. Disenchantment, dispassion, release. Let's sit for just a moment.